Talking history. This is News Talk.
Here lies Arthur, the king who was and king who will be. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the legends of King Arthur and exploring why the story of the once and future king has fascinated writers, poets, composers and filmmakers for almost 1,000 years. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text 53106 and text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week we looked at the history of the Pyrenees, code breaking in Ireland during the Second World War, and the history of the Holy Land in our monthly book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or go directly to iTunes. In tonight's show, we're exploring the legend of King Arthur. The story of King Arthur has inspired poets and writers, composers and filmmakers for centuries. There are many elements to the story of the British king who unified the land against invaders and created an idealized kingdom based at Camelot. We have the legend of Excalibur, the wizard Merlin, the Lady of the Lake, Lancelot and the Knights of the Round Table, the quest for the Holy Grail, all told and retold, imagined and reimagined, with each new teller adding new elements and new layers to the story. So in tonight's show, we want to try and separate these layers. Does the story of King Arthur have any basis in historical fact? How do different writers imagine and add to the story? And why does the story of King Arthur continue to inspire and entrance? Well, to help me address these questions and more, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Margaret Robson teaches in the School of English at Trinity College Dublin and is an expert on Arthurian literature. Professor Nicholas J. Higgum is Professor Emeritus in History at the University of Manchester and is the author of King Arthur, The Making of the Legend. Dr. Jennifer Farrell is a lecturer in medieval history at the University of Exeter, and her expertise includes Geoffrey of Monmouth and representations of magic in the Middle Ages. Professor Anne Lawrence Mathers lectures in medieval history at the University of Reading and is an expert on the relationship between medieval magic and science, and she's the author of The True History of Merlin the Magician. Dr. Alan Lupak is the creator and editor of the Camelot Project, an award-winning database of Arthurian texts, images, bibliographies and information, and he's written extensively on medieval and modern Arthurian literature, including the Oxford Guide to Arthurian Literature and Legend, and he's also the co-author of King Arthur in America. Well, you're all very welcome. And Margaret, I might start with you, and I might start with the biggest and maybe the most difficult question of all, and that is, why has the story of King Arthur inspired, intrigued people for almost 1,000 years?
I think the real thing about King Arthur is that he's such a protean figure, and because he is genuinely ahistorical, although people are still trying to look for and identify the places which Arthur belonged to and which he came from. Nobody has done so yet successfully. I mean, this will be an argument that other people will have. But because he does emerge from this kind of prehistory in writers like Gildas and Nennius, moving, and Geoffrey of Monmouth is the first time that he sort of enters into proper chronicle tradition, you can do anything with him. You can have him as this figure who has a dog and a spear and a sword, which makes him a very primitive kind of figure. And you can see him there as this, you know, sort of misty figure from the borders of Wales, which is where he mostly comes from. Or then you can have him as the most noble Christian king, which is what you get in the text of English Arthurianism, which is Malory's Morte d'Arthur from the 15th century. There in the High Middle Ages, he's the kind of knight of the Round Table. He has Lancelot, he has all his other knights. And then, so you can make him into a primitive figure. You can make him into a kind of freedom fighter, if you like, who's fighting against the Saxons, or you can make him into this noble Christian king of the High Middle Ages. You can do what you like, and you can even end up with, there's a 2007 volume, it's a young adult's version of Arthurian literature, Philip Reeve's Here Lies Arthur, in which there's a kind of gender-bending thing going on, and Arthur is an inadequate king, a battle leader, not very satisfactory in any way, and it's the stories that are told about him that are most important. So you can do what you like, and it's this protean nature which makes him so acceptable to write, so useful. And to propaganda.
so useful, and therefore he's ripe for reinvention in every generation.
In any way you like, you can give him his dog, you can take away his dog, you can give him his spear, you can give him his sword, you can say, where does his sword come from? You can say, where is Camelot? Any and all of the above. Or you can give him real political power. You can place him in centres of real power and do something and talk about authority, the nature of authority, the transference of power, the transmission of a regnal line, which is the things that Malory is mostly interested in. So he has a lot of scope.
He has an awful lot of scope. Nicholas, I might ask you the next big question, which is there any historical basis to say that Arthur was a real person? Because again, in different centuries, people try to make the claim that he was Roman or maybe that he was from a different country outside of Britain. And then there's claims that he in fact was from Wales or from England or from somewhere else. That there have been all these attempts to try and say, yes, there is some truth behind the legend.
There are all sorts of claims. There's the claim that he's Sarmatian. There's the claim that he's Greek. There's the claim that he's a Roman centurion who ends up as a small-time governor in part of Dalmatia. There are all sorts of claims for a very early Arthur. If you actually look at them very closely, it's very difficult to see how those figures could have actually arrived in Wales, where the legend starts, in the 9th century. So I think you have to sort of put those aside, really, and focus in on what's happening in the early 9th century when somebody that we tend to think of by the name Nennius was writing a work which we tend to call the History of the Britons. He didn't call it that. And he actually develops this Arthur figure, chapter 56, his wonderful king list, his list of battles, 12 battles, and sets him up as the great British hero fighting the Saxons. But a writer in the early 9th century, what does he actually know about what was happening in the British Dark Age? Answer relatively little outside of what he got from earlier authors. And he doesn't occur in the obvious source that Nennius was using, which is Gildas, who's writing probably in the early 6th century. So, I mean, my own feeling is that he's actually being developed for political reasons in the early 9th century at a moment when the North Welsh are in a terrible state, really. The original dynasty of the kingdom have ended. They now have a new man, a man called Murfin, who seems to have come from the Isle of Man, who isn't a direct member of the lineage. He's probably married the daughter of one of the last kings. And the Saxon overlordship has just been reestablished by the West Saxons, who've actually overtaken the Mercians in terms of power in England. So it's a political crisis. The North Welsh kingship is in itself in crisis, even without that. And Nennius is writing a work which is highly political about trying to gee up the Britons to believe in themselves, to believe that they have a heroic past, and Arthur is a feature of that past.
And Nicholas, do you think that sometimes people are too quick to try and seize on any available evidence to make their case that he was real? Like, for example, they look at the name Arthur, and that wasn't too common in Celtic sources. So they look at the name Arturius and therefore say that he must have been a Roman soldier who ended up in Britain.
Well, Arthur does probably derive from the Roman name Artorius. It's by far the simplest explanation. But a lot of Roman names come through into the Welsh name-giving in the Dark Ages and onwards. names like Constantine are found there, you see. So there's no reason whatsoever why it has to be the centurion Artorius, who was a historic figure in the late second century. In fact, Artorius, the centurion, would have probably been known as Castus, not Artorius, because that was the name that he was given that he would generally be known by. Artorius is his family name, so I don't think it stands up at all, frankly.
Excellent. So you'd be fairly confident that there's no historical basis?
Pretty much. I mean, there is actually rather an interesting Irish connection, because Murfin came from the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man is Gaelic-speaking and a centre probably for a fairly diverse culture, which is picking pieces from North Britain, the sort of Cumbria area, and southwest Scotland, but also from Northern Ireland and from western Scotland. And there was somebody called Arthur or Artur, who was a son of the King of the Scots in the late 6th century, whose name might have actually given him the idea, I think.
Yeah, nice parallel there. Britain almost certainly gave us St. Patrick, so in return then we can give Britain King Arthur.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Very, very ecumenical. Okay, Jennifer, can I talk to you about Geoffrey of Monmouth? Because you're doing some really interesting work there. And it's interesting that he did so much to kind of create the early story of King Arthur, but was doing it not as a myth or a romance or a story. He was doing it as a type of history.
Yeah, absolutely. Geoffrey really is the first to produce a more extensive description of Arthur and certainly Arthur's reign. So it's the most detailed, it's the earliest of the detailed accounts we get of this figure known as King Arthur. And also Geoffrey does identify him very clearly as a king and situates him in this pseudo-historical framework. He puts him among the list of roughly 90 kings and queens who ruled Britain before the coming of the Saxons. So he has it very much as a single nation, the island of Britain all united under one ruler named Arthur. But Geoffrey is certainly using or inspired by older traditions, but there's a lot of debate over exactly where those traditions are coming from. Most of the material that we see as related to Arthur post-dates Geoffrey in its written form. Nennius, I mean, is an obvious exception there, but I mean, Geoffrey expands on that version of the story dramatically. And as Nicholas pointed out, you know, Nennius is writing within a political context and for political reasons. And Geoffrey does the exact same thing. It's different political context, but he is again adapting these earlier traditions to suit his own ends. And he expands on them quite dramatically. And in fact, a lot of the kind of key elements of the early stories of Arthur are provided by Geoffrey, and certainly the identification of figures like Mordred, his wife who's named Gonamara, and she becomes Guinevere, even down to his sword, which Geoffrey calls Caliburnus, and that later becomes Excalibur. So all of that is found in Geoffrey's story, and also the affair that happens between Arthur's wife Gonamara and his nephew Mordred. So he later gets replaced by Lancelot in French versions of the story. But, you know, you can see the foundations of it there with what Geoffrey is doing in the mid to late 1130s, writing at Oxford.
And you also have Merlin in this interpretation.
Indeed, you do. So Geoffrey's history, it's the history of the kings of Britain, and he goes back to the founding of the island by Trojan survivor Brutus. And there's a long list of kings and queens, most of them mythical, So the subject of Geoffrey's imagination. But in book seven, this entire book is filled with the prophecies of Merlin. So these are prophecies that Geoffrey says, you know, he's translating. Geoffrey also says he's translating this history of the kings of Britain from a very old book in the British tongue, which has been the subject of a lot of debate among historians, and most dismiss it as just a ruse by Geoffrey. But the Prophecies of Merlin, that's actually the first reference to Arthur in the piece, where he says, he describes Arthur as the Boar of Cornwall. And he says that the Boar of Cornwall will provide a respite from the Saxon attacks in Britain, that he'll trample the foreigners' necks beneath his feet, the islands of the ocean will fall under his sway, he will occupy the glades of France, and Rome will tremble before his rage. And then he finally goes on to say his end will be unknown, which goes back to that idea of him being the once and future king. So did he really die or not? So all of that's set up in the Prophecies of Merlin. And then when Arthur does appear again, it's the result of Merlin's magic. So King Uther Pendragon falls in love with a married woman, Igerna, the Duchess of Cornwall, and he employs Merlin and uses Merlin's herbs to transform himself into the likeness of Gorlois, Igerna's husband, gains access to Igerna. We're told that that night they make love and the very renowned King Arthur is conceived. So Merlin is playing a direct hand in kind of bringing Arthur into the scene. And when Uther dies, Arthur is made king. And he's crowned king by Dubricius, the Archbishop of Caerleon. And, you know, he rids the island of the Saxons. So he has those battles that were made famous in Nennius, the most famous of which is the Battle of Badon Hill. And we're told that Arthur unsheathes his sword Celeburnus and lays low 470 men himself. You know, so really inspiring his troops as a great military leader. He conquers Ireland, Iceland, Orkney, the Orkney Islands, France. He's moving on France, and he finally restores peace in Britain, having expelled the Saxons. And when he's marching on Rome, Rome is demanding tribute from Britain. Arthur refuses to pay this tribute, feels that Britain is just as powerful and glorious as Rome. When he's marching on Rome, he hears word that his nephew Mordred has usurped the throne and effectively united in love with Arthur's wife, Gonamara. And this is the beginning of the Civil War, which ultimately leads to Arthur's death, which Geoffrey dates to 542. And of this, Geoffrey says, he was mortally wounded on the battlefield and he was carried off to the Isle of Avalon to have his wounds tended, which is a fairly ambiguous ending and caused kind of no end of debate since then. And that's more or less the story as Geoffrey describes it.
And it's extraordinary. And then so much was built onto that story then, and elements adapted and elements changed. But what I find fascinating is the character of Merlin, who you've written about, and the fact that magic is being, and prophecy is being introduced into what's attempting to be a history. But perhaps the surprising thing is that this wouldn't have discredited in the eyes of people, because there was a different view of these things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was nothing unusual about prophecy being included in works of history. I mean, a lot of histories had prophecies, and indeed, the Old Testament, which was usually seen as a model for historical writing, was filled with prophecies. So there was nothing unusual in that. And in fact, Merlin's prophecies may have added greater weight and meaning to Geoffrey's history, because they provided something of a bridge between, you know, the pre-Saxon past, which he's describing, and the contemporary 12th century context in which he's actually writing it. And a lot of his prophecies were certainly interpreted as political allegories for figures and events in the 12th century. But I think with Arthur, having that prophecy of Arthur that I described as the Boar of Cornwall, it also builds anticipation in the rest of the work. That prophecy is described in Book 7. But it's not until books 9 through 11 that we get the description of Arthur's reign. So by the time the reader has finished reading up to, as far as book 7, they're anticipating, they're expecting Arthur's reign. They know it's going to be glorious, but they also know that after hearing about all these conquests, that his end is going to be unknown and ambiguous. They know that this character is going to be important. That not only builds anticipation and excitement for hearing the story, but I think it probably caused contemporary readers to pay more attention to the story and perhaps to link it back to their own political context. And the political context is certainly important. I mean, Geoffrey's writing in the 1130s. There's a succession crisis in England. And Geoffrey, you know, really explains that Arthur is the legitimate heir to the throne. as the son of the deceased king. And he emphasizes the whole way through the history the importance of keeping the throne in the direct line. So Arthur's story, in a way, stands as a model of the importance of succession by inheritance rather than by usurpation, which is exactly what his nephew Mordred does.
Excellent, Anne. I'll bring you in on this because your work, The True History of Merlin the Magician, deals with some of these as well. And it is very interesting, that relationship between magical and scientific beliefs in the Middle Ages.
Yes, and also the other complexity, following on from what's just been said, is the relationship between prophecy, which, to be technically prophecy, is divinely inspired and therefore not magical, and magical ways of predicting the future, which the technical and negative term was divination. And Geoffrey of Monmouth, in his History of the Kings of Britain, has some negative figures who use necromancy and divination from the flights of birds and things. And they're in a way contrasted with Merlin, whose prophecies, as we've just heard, are genuine, and who can perform magic, but it's what was called in the 12th century natural magic. So he's an incredibly powerful figure, but sits right on the border between magic, prophecy, medicine, science, and all sorts of things that were incredibly glamorous and exciting and new in the 12th century.
Very good. Alan, I'll bring you in on this because it is very interesting that Arthur then, the story of Arthur is in some ways like an onion with all of these layers. And you have the Arthur of the 21st century with all of the legends kind of established. We have Merlin and Lancelot and the Round Table, and we have Avalon and Camelot. But you peel back every layer and you see what's been added by different writers, different poets, and who's been adding elements to the narrative.
Yes, there are always new elements being added and new reasons why people are interested in the Arthurian legends. One of the things that fascinates me is the way the whole concept of chivalry develops in the 18th and 19th century, so that what you get writers writing about is a kind of moral chivalry. So chivalry, instead of being a matter of knights or noblemen having the wealth and the status to become a knight, becomes a matter of morality. And you have a pattern in historians and antiquarians in the 18th and 19th century writing about this, and it's codified, I suppose, in the 19th century by a man named Kenelm Digby, who wrote a book called The Broad Stone of Honor. And he talks at great length about knighthood and suggests that knighthood is something that existed in all ages and still exists right up to the time of his writing. And it is, in effect, as he defines it, a moral matter. And you can find traces of this in earlier writers, so much so that a number of writers, including Bishop Percy in the introduction to his Relics of Ancient English Poetry, compares an Arthurian romance to classical poetry and says it's just as regular as the conduct is just as regular as what's found in classical poetry. And this, I suppose, this is encapsulated in Tennyson's lines about Sir Galahad: "My strength is as the strength of 10, because my heart is pure." And so if one's purity of heart is what makes one a great knight and capable in that poem of achieving the Grail, then anyone is capable of having a pure heart. And there's almost a democratization of knighthood and chivalry. And this plays out in many ways in the literature and in the social attitudes in the 19th century. We had in America a group called the Knights of King Arthur that was founded at the very end of the 19th century. And it was a club initially for boys, and later girls were allowed to join, in a branch called the Queens of Avalon. And so what you had was a club that attempted to promote values by having the children read about and enact in their own lives the values and virtues of knights. Now, of course, this ignores a lot of what knights do in history and in literature. You know, Malory was at one time thought of as something detrimental to youth. And so in the Renaissance, you have writers writing about how it's terrible if young people are reading Malory's stories. But for William Byron Forbush, the minister who founded the Knights of King Arthur, and for other writers of the day, their story of Arthur is filtered through Tennyson and Tennyson's moral notions of knighthood. And so they hold it up as a model and as a way of encouraging boys to do good things.
And Alan, what is it about the story of Arthur that has inspired you to do so much work on him? The Camelot project, for example, which has brought together such wonderful material, that it has been a life's pursuit and a life's passion.
Yes, although it started, you know, not in childhood for me, as it does for many people, but much later in graduate school, and as I began learning more and more about literature and art, I noticed that the Arthurian legends are everywhere. One finds poetry and drama and novels, in addition to the medieval romances, which I studied in my graduate work, but I became fascinated by all of the appearances of the Arthurian legends in later literature and art and music. It's just found everywhere, and I began obsessively collecting Arthurian books and films and film posters and so on. And I'm just fascinated by the scope of it and by how much one can do. And so in my scholarly writing, I've written on everything from medieval literature to modern movies, all under the rubric of the Arthurian legend.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be discussing how the story of King Arthur evolved over the centuries and take it up to the present day film representations. What is the most accurate of these Arthurian interpretations, if indeed there is one, and lots more besides, coming up after the break.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the legend and indeed the legacy of the story of King Arthur. I'm delighted to be joined by Margaret Robson, Nicholas Higgum, Jennifer Farrell and Lawrence Mathers and Alan Lupak. Margaret, can we talk about Sir Thomas Malory and his interpretation, his version of the King Arthur story? Because that seems to be the one that has most of the elements that we're familiar with today.
I think that's partly because it's 15th century prose as opposed to 14th century or earlier poetry. So it's easier to read. And it's something that undergraduates often, that's an introduction to Arthurian literature. It's either that or Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. These are the two literary texts that we come across. But I think really Malory, he is the text, because not just because he's easy, but because he has all those components. He sort of marries together the historical, the chronicle aspect of it and the romances. So you have Lancelot, you have Guinevere, you have the Holy Grail. You don't get those in earlier English chronicle versions. You don't have the Grail legends, they're French. But what is most interesting, I think, really about Malory is the way in which he writes about this disunited kingdom. And the disunited kingdom which he writes about is one through which he is living. So he's writing it in the 1460s. He's dead by the time that it is printed by Caxton in 1485. But really, we're talking about a time when legitimacy and authority and kingship is massively disputed. So this really begins in 1399 with the deposition and murder of Richard II by his cousin, who then comes to the throne as Henry IV. So Henry IV is unproblematically kind of succeeded by his son, Henry V, who is then succeeded by his son, Henry VI. But when Henry VI comes to the throne, he's a baby. He's months old. And Malory actually writes at the beginning of the Mort d'Arthur, "Then stood the realm in jeopardy long while." There is no ruler. They don't know who the ruler is going to be. And many men of great estate think to make themselves strong, and they're trying to govern through them. Henry VI had a miserable life, so he is king, but in name only a lot of the time. And it's really, that's where the Wars of the Roses begin, from 1399. So you've got Henry VI, he's succeeded, he's deposed by his nephew, who becomes king as Edward IV, who then is himself, you know, he sort of goes off for a while. Henry VI is restored. You've got this whole civil war going on, all these battles that are happening throughout the land, and the land is destroyed. And this is what happens at the end of Malory. You've left with this wasteland. After Henry VI, you've got Edward IV. After Edward IV, you've got his brother, who is Richard III. Richard III has a very, very tenuous claim to the throne. In fact, he has declared his nephew, who should have been king, illegitimate. So questions of legitimacy, of rule, of lineal descent are absolutely crucial. So he only becomes king at that point. He then is challenged by the guy who comes to the throne as Henry VII, who is no relation, really, except in a very broad term, to Henry VI. It's a mess. It is an absolute shambles. Then stood the realm in jeopardy long while. And what Malory does is he seizes this historical moment and he says, when Uther was king and so reigned. And then he gives a legitimate birth story for Arthur. He legitimates it in various ways, which is perhaps not time to go into now, maybe later. But how he also legitimates Arthur's claim to the throne. Arthur is the legitimate son of Uther Pendragon by his wife, by the woman who he marries after Arthur is conceived, Igraine. But there's a much talk about that. But what he then does is provide the story of the sword in the stone. And the sword in the stone appears in the churchyard. And Malory actually says, whether it were Paul's or not, I don't know. So it gives it real political centre, real political power. And the sword in the stone can only be pulled out by whoever is rightwise king born of all England. Arthur does this the first time by accident, and then he has to do it on subsequent occasions. So he does it on New Year's Day, he does it on Candlemas, he does it at Easter, he does it at Pentecost, because people keep saying, this is a boy, we don't know who he is, he's not here, how can he possibly be king? We don't know his parentage. But his authority is underwritten by God. That's the sword Excalibur that he pulls from the stone, and that's what gives him the right to rule. And eventually the people at Pentecost say, yes, he has done this. God is on his side. He knows. Now, what is interesting about that is that that sword, which is called Excalibur, breaks very, very soon. You know, magic swords should not break. This should be the sign of his power. What then happens is that Merlin leads him to a lake and gets him another sword from the Lady of the Lake. So Arthur, the woman, the hand appears from the water and gives him the sword. And this is the one that has the scabbard that also means that he won't lose blood. He won't die. Now, this is also referred to as Excalibur later on, and that's the sword that he returns at the end. So Arthur has an authenticating Christian sword, which legitimates him in the eyes of the people, but he also has a sword from the water. And this is a gift from some kind of pre-Christian past, and it involves a world of magic and women. Arthur's in both of those worlds. At the end, he returns to Avalon. He returns the sword to the lake, and then he's brought away to Avalon. Does he come back? We don't know. You know, this is a possibility. But these ideas of legitimacy of rule and of authority and power are absolutely crucial in Malory. And at some points, Malory actually steps outside telling the story and says, lo, ye all English, see ye not what a mischief is here? Why are you rising up against Arthur? There's a huge, you know, all these battles you have at the end when Arthur and Mordred, who is in this version his incestuously begotten son, and that's another problem. You know, there are so many problems. Malory seizes this moment. He writes about his own times, and he writes about this in a way of legitimating monarchy and authority. Now, what's even perhaps it, I mean, this is chance as well, that in 1485 you get the final battle when Richard III is defeated by the guy who comes to the throne as Henry Tudor, Henry VII, and Caxton then prints this for the first time. So it's Malory's dead. You know, he couldn't have known that any of this was going to happen, but it's cometh the hour and cometh the text. And it then becomes, it's used by the Tudors as forms of political propaganda.
So it's a good story to have for a disunited kingdom facing political chaos, uncertain about its future. I wonder why we're doing it tonight. Okay, very good. Alan, what about the element of the Grail? When is that added into the story and the quest for the Holy Grail? And that seems to become such an important part of the story.
Well, it does. It's a spiritual aspect, although it starts in the 12th century, basically. There may have been motifs earlier that led to that concept. But Chrétien de Troyes, in his romance about Percival, tells the story of the Grail, and that becomes extremely popular. And you have a number of people who are trying to finish the story, which Chrétien left incomplete, which may have been one of the most important things he did, because it led so many others to attempt to continue that story and to retell it. And then the Grail gets taken into stories like that of Mallory's Maud d'Arthur and passed on to other writers like Tennyson, and becomes an essential part of the Arthurian story.
And it's interesting because the story of the Grail, say, then is taken up by composers like Richard Wagner with Parsifal, and it's something that goes on to inspire other writers.
Yes, many other writers, many Grail stories and poems, and even filmmakers, and of course lots of art. But, you know, you have Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and you have Eric Rohmer's Percival film, which is very close to Chrétien's for much of the film. So you have a lot of inspiration coming from that. And then you have things like Tennyson's poem Sir Galahad, which is often reprinted and repeated, and as I said before, influencing much of what happens later in the Arthurian legend. And you have many paintings of the Holy Grail and Galahad on the quest for the Holy Grail. So it becomes almost omnipresent in the culture.
Very good. Nicholas, it's interesting when you look at how the story does resonate. I'm interested in how it becomes this idealized vision of the world. And we even see that in the way John F. Kennedy's presidency is referred to as Camelot, all because Jackie Kennedy gave that interview to Life magazine after the assassination, when she referenced how he loved the musical Camelot and quoted the line, "Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot," and this suggestion that there would never be another Camelot again, that it became part of that mythology for the presidency.
But he's got everything, hasn't he? I mean, it's the sort of figure who does emerge in that sort of way. He starts by coming out of myth, legend, fiction, whatever you like, as the man who wins all his battles. He's the Christian figure. He's got Christ, the Virgin Mary, and God all backing him. He's wins 12 great battles. 12 is, of course, the number of the disciples. He's a very much a sort of biblical figure in this. And he actually slays, in the original Aeneas, he slays 960 in one charge by his own sword alone. And that is pretty good going. You know, he's a sort of tank. So I think he starts off with this great sort of surge, and then people begin to pick up and pull in a lot of other stories to his. And so he ends up as a sort of center around which all the other stories coalesce and flow. And you end with him having this sort of huge court. And a lot of the stories actually are the people, you know, the Knights of the Round Table. The Round Table is invented in the middle of the 12th century in order to accommodate all these people and not have them fighting each other. You can see how the whole thing sort of rolls forward, and it becomes very much a national story. Of course, it's originally a national story for the Welsh against the Saxons, but once the Saxons are defeated, I think 1066 is extraordinarily important in the development of the Arthurian story, because the Normans rather like the idea of looking back to a legitimate previous ruler of Britain who isn't a Saxon, because they, of course, have killed Harold at Hastings. And so they pick up, they leapfrog back to the Britons, pick it up in the 12th century, and then run with it. And because they are writing, well, they're writing in Latin, but they're also speaking French, it then escapes into the continent, into the French language, and into most other European languages, right the way across the whole of Europe, as far as the east, with the Franks taking, for example, Constantinople at the beginning of the 13th century. So, you know, he's sort of broadcast. He becomes a satellite figure, if you like.
Very good. And I have some criticisms that I want to bring you about Merlin and Arthur, because there is this idealized view of Camelot and King Arthur. But some of the things, some elements of the story are shocking. For example, Merlin has a prophecy that a child born, I think, on May Day will be the undoing of Arthur. So Arthur massacres all of the children born on that day, and then Mordred ends up not being killed. So he isn't even able to escape the prophecy. But elements like that show a ruthlessness, and it's not really the idealistic Arthur of some of the, say, film representations.
No, and that's one of that ambiguity about magic and prophecy, and whether you can use magic and be innocent and heroic and noble without also being doomed is one of the big themes about the whole story, I would say. Because as we've already heard, Arthur is only conceived and only made possible to fulfill his, you know, wonderful, magical, heroic role in Britain when Merlin takes on responsibility for using magic to deceive a virtuous married woman into committing adultery.
And in fact, it's effectively she's raped.
Exactly. And then in later versions of the story, that's picked up even further, and we're told that Merlin takes the baby away from her soon after he's born, so she never even gets to bring up this baby that she's suffered to produce. And that seems to me to be partly why in some of the late medieval stories, including in Malory's version, though it's not so important there, Merlin is punished. The female magical figures invent really cruel ways of inflicting perpetual semi-death and suffering on Merlin. So this theme of sexuality, of the battle between the sexes and the battle between different types of magic and different magical objects, weaves around Arthur, even though Arthur himself, oddly in a way, is not magical. He's somehow completely human.
And do you think then that there's been a tendency in say 20th century and 21st century versions of Arthur to maybe simplify the story and remove those kinds of the elements of darkness and the nuances, and that the story is worse as a result?
I think different people have seen different needs at different phases and use the story in different ways. Just as we heard about Malory writing in a dark time, I'd say that White invents his child Arthur, you know, the focus on that child Arthur and the sword in the stone, with Merlin as a twinkly tutor, so-called, with lots of almost fairy tale versions of magic. And that's about sort of clinging onto hope in the dark time of the Second World War, and hoping for better times to come. And that's a simplification of the story, because it, in a lot of ways, takes out the negative and more worrying implications of the magic. And of course, ultimately, just as in all the versions of the story, the magic fails. So I think the story, by that stage, by the 20th century, the story is so complicated that it's almost inevitable that every version has to pick a mix. You can't have everything all at once, if that makes sense.
And it's interesting you mentioning T.H. White's Once and Future King, because that pops up in other stories as well. I even remember at the end of one of the X-Men movies, Professor X, Professor Xavier, played by Patrick Stewart, starts reading that story to the children, and it becomes part of the mythology of other stories.
Yes. I mean, this thing about time and magic is so important, I think, too, that, you know, Arthur comes from the past, he creates a wonderful but doomed present, but somehow both vanishes but survives into the future, just like Merlin and I guess Morgan Le Fay and the Lady in the Lake and all of these magical figures. Time is very important, but multi-layered, and genuinely, you know, all times are present at once in some ways.
Jennifer, you're currently working on a project about the representations of magic and medieval ideas about gender, and you're making use of the Arthurian romances for that. And I wonder, is in the Arthurian story, are women portrayed in a negative way, because you see them very often as villains in the story?
Yeah, I mean, they can be, and they certainly have been portrayed in quite negative ways, particularly in the Arthurian romances, the kind of Vulgate and post-Vulgate cycles. But, you know, if you look at, you know, the non-traditional Arthurian romances with non-traditional heroes, so like The Lay of Marie de France, which I'm doing quite a bit of work on at the moment, you have like Lanfal is a knight and Arthur is not a great king. This is in the late 12th century. He fails as knight. His knight is a chivalric hero. He's done great service to Arthur and Arthur ignores him and overlooks him in the exchange of gifts of wives and land. So Lanfal goes off and finds a fairy to fall in love with. And he has a sexual relationship with this fairy. The fairy provides him with money and patronage, and basically gives him everything that Arthur and his court are unable to give him. And, you know, I mean, at the end of that work, Lanfal effectively jumps onto the back of the fairy horse and goes with her to Avalon. So he, like, abandons his knighthood and abandons Arthur because Arthur is not as powerful as this fairy. And the fairy seems to have done good by Lanfal. But, you know, as others like Corinne Saunders have pointed out, that the other world, the fairy world, is to be feared as well as longed for. So Lanfal's end is a little ambiguous, too. But later English writers like Thomas Chester take up this Lanfal story and, you know, they make the fairy a lot more critical of Arthur. She's very critical of Arthur and of Arthur's wife, Guinevere. So sometimes these women, they're complex, and I don't think they're necessarily portrayed as either good or bad. It's not very black and white, but they do tap into the universal themes of the Arthurian story, which we've heard so much about. I mean, it can be effectively adapted to suit the needs of any writer and of any generation.
Very good. Alan, do you have a particularly, do you have a favourite representation of Arthur? And please don't say Sean Connery in First Knight.
No, I wouldn't say that. Well, I love Malory's romance more than any other work of literature, and so almost for almost anything Arthurian, that would be my favorite. But I do like T.H. White's depiction of him. Tennyson's is a bit stiff, I think, because Arthur is he doesn't have very nice attitudes towards women. He tells Guinevere that she's ruined his great plan. T.H. White, I think, has an author who is torn in the way that maybe Lancelot is in Malory's depiction of the Arthurian stories, in that he loves Lancelot and Guinevere and yet has to condemn them. And I think this is one of the things that I find so fascinating about the Arthurian story, and particularly the great versions like Malory's. And I would put T.H. White very high up on the list of those that I like. And that is that often you find that the problem is not good versus evil, as it is in some of the lesser and more simplistic retellings of the Arthurian legend, but it's really good versus good. There are all kinds of codes that Lancelot in Malory and Arthur in T.H. White are trying to live up to. Lancelot, for example, in Malory is torn between his chivalric code, his duty to his king, the courtly love code, the religious code, in which he tries to seek the Holy Grail and to deny his instinct to love Guinevere, and it's the values and the codes, the goods that are used against them by villains like Mordred. Especially in T.H. White, where he forces, and in Malory, where he forces Arthur into a decision to condemn those that he loves. And so I think one of the things that's so fascinating about the Arthurian legends is that you do, on the one hand, it's seen as a story almost for children and by many people, but you do get these real-life questions of values and of goods and of codes that one has to live up to.
And it's incredible to look at your resource, the Camelot Project, and people Google the Camelot Project, they'll find it. It's an open access resource, and it has, even when you go through the list of authors and texts that are available on it, there's so many who are inspired by elements of the story, including our own W.B. Yeats. It is an incredible reach that the story has.
It is indeed. And you asked before about what attracted me to the legend, and one of the things is that there are so many authors, people you wouldn't suspect, who have taken up the Arthurian legends. And sometimes they start with a knowledge of the legends from childhood. For example, John Steinbeck is an author who fascinates me. We think of him as writing social novels about the poor and the downtrodden, but really much of his literature is shaped by the Arthurian legends and by his readings of a version of Malory as a child. And we see this in not only in The Acts of King Arthur, which was a translation or a modernization of Malory that he was working on for much of his life, but also in a number of his stories, his tales, where he deliberately tries to make the reader conscious of the Arthurian element, even going so far as in a novel called Sweet Thursday to write a kind of comic version of in the modern world of Malory's story. And he has characters that clearly reflect Malory's characters, but come to a happy ending.
Very good. Margaret, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to leave the final word to you. And that is, do you think the story of Arthur will continue to inspire writers and filmmakers and poets for the next 1,000 years?
Absolutely. But I just want to sort of address that. My favourite Arthurian thing is Monty Python, because it has serious things to say. The gift of a sword by some watery tart is no basis for the executive. There are some people who don't like the idea of a monarchy being in charge of things. Those kinds of questions posed in that humorous way are genuine questions, and Arthurian legend can pose genuine questions to all of us, and that's why I think it will carry on.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end, and I'm glad we got more Monty Python in as well. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts for bringing King Arthur to life once again for us. Dr. Margaret Robson, Professor Nicholas Higham, Dr. Jennifer Farrell, Professor Anne Lawrence Mathers, and Dr. Alan Lupak. And I'm afraid that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. Happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. I hope you had a great day. My thanks to Susan Cahill, my producer, Chris Bent on sound. Next week, we're going to be looking at the life and work of the 19th century poet Emily Dickinson, and we'll be finding out how her work continues to inspire in the 21st century. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.